Welcome to Holy Unhappiness, conversations about the expectations we have of what the life of faith will feel like. I'm your host, Amanda Held Opelt, author of the book Holy Unhappiness, God, Goodness, and the Myth of the Blessed Life. Each week, I'll be speaking with writers, pastors, artists, and friends about the myths we believe about the good life. Together, we'll reimagine what blessing can look like if we are willing to look beyond our culture's definition of happiness and success. Welcome. I'm glad you're here. Thanks so much for tuning in again. I really appreciate it. As you may recall, May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And so for the next few weeks, I'm interviewing experts in the field of mental health, psychology, and spiritual care to glean from some of their wisdom on the topic of pain, anxiety, depression, melancholy, grief, and trauma. And our guest for today is not only a licensed therapist, he has also served as a pastor. Now, I don't know about you, but in my experience, many people in the church, pastors even, really just don't know what to do with acute mental health struggles. Many didn't know how to help people who were struggling and came to them. Maybe they felt in over their heads totally when these types of issues come up. And in fact, I've even experienced pastors who were hesitant to believe in the reality of mental illness. They believed, well, if you can just confess your sins and purge yourself of sinful thoughts, then you'll be at peace and be happy. I'm sorry if this is your experience. I'm sorry that it was mine. And I also want to name and acknowledge that there have been abuses, both physical and spiritual, within faith context that have been profoundly traumatizing for people, often precipitating their struggles with mental health. My guest today doesn't believe it has to be this way. In fact, he's written extensively about the types of behaviors that lead to abuses in churches, and he continues to advocate for the important role that mental health resources can play in the church and for the beautiful practice of soul care within the Christian tradition. Chuck DeGroat is a licensed therapist, a spiritual director, author of 5 books, and a retreat leader and speaker. He is a professor of counseling and Christian spirituality and executive director of the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at Western Theological Seminary and a faculty member for the Soul Care Institute. As a therapist, he specialized in issues of abuse and trauma, pastoral and leadership health, and navigating issues of doubt and dark nights of the faith journey. He's also a minister of the Word and Sacrament in the Reformed Church in America. He's pastored in Orlando and San Francisco before transitioning to training and forming pastors. And he lives with his wife, and he's got 2 daughters. And I am just so excited to interview him, to talk with him. This is exactly the kind of person I need to talk about these very delicate issues. So I hope you listen in. It is awesome to finally have a face-to-face conversation with you, even though it's through a computer screen.
Yeah.
Better than just sending messages. I want to just thank you so much for all the encouragement. Every now and then you just pop a message over to me to say, hey, good work. I appreciate what you're doing. And that means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Your books, both of your books have been gifts. And I mean, we were just talking about this beforehand, right? Your work on grief, I'm just constantly sharing with others. And so, and quoting from in my next book. And so it's sort of, yeah, it's mutual. So thanks for inviting me to have this conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot we could talk about. I mean, the number of times we've referenced you and your work in our church, you know, your book, When Narcissism Comes to Church, we use that as a reference point in all of our elder meetings as like, okay, what do we need to do to safeguard, create the setups that make for the right accountability within the church setting and keep us all humble and self-reflective. Yeah. It's so important. And I've brought you on today because you are both a pastor and a counselor, and you are kind of spending your days talking with people at that clinical level about mental health issues. And you're also somebody who's done that pastoral work. I think you have a lot of perspective to offer to this conversation. And I think the thing I want to kind of start our conversation with, if I could, and I know this is a loaded question, I know we could talk for hours and hours about this, but I think what I would love to hear is just at the most basic level, what do you, as both a pastor and a licensed therapist, what do you wish all Christians and particularly pastors knew about just the reality of mental health struggles?
Yeah. So, it's a good question. And it's, in some ways it's a complicated question. We could tease it out in a number of ways.
Yeah.
I think back to the first church that I served in where mental health struggles were sort of stigmatized and I was called to be a pastor at that church, but I was also called, I've started church-based counseling centers at two different churches, one in Orlando, one in San Francisco. But in that first church in particular, and this is back in the 1990s, the late 1990s. So it might be kind of, that might be part of the reason.
Yeah.
But I remember the leadership sort of saying, we want you to start a counseling center within the church, but over there, so that all those people, notice the emphasis, all those people can go over there to get counseling, right?
Yeah.
And so there was a sense that the people with mental health problems were sort of in their own separate category and the rest of us were kind of normal. And I would kind of want to blow that up. I would want to say it's not, if you'll be challenged in that way, it's how and when you'll be challenged with mental health issues, either in your own life or in the lives of people you love. And I think we're all on a spectrum in terms of our ways of coping, right? And I think part of the problem is we've got this big, thick book in the counseling world called the DSM-5, and it's got all of the disorders. And it's sort of like, there are a number of things that have become sort of pathologized. We've got big names and categories and numbers, and it's spooky almost, And then there's the rest of us who we think are normal. But the reality is even if we don't get a code or diagnosis, the rest of us are probably perfectionists and workaholics and functional alcalcoholics and the things that keep our head above water. So we don't get the code, And so I'd want to say, like, let's take our cue from the Psalms. I mean, there's a whole range of emotions and experiences that apply to all of us. The book of Psalms, the Psalms are not for particular individuals that have problems and that require a code, right? And so I want to say, let's all see ourselves as on a journey, suffering, struggling in ways that we're hopefully growing and maturing along the way. Does that help? Does that make sense?
It does. And that's the perspective I so wish I'd had kind of in my early 20s. I always tell people my parents had us in these really safe, healthy churches my whole growing up experience. I'm so grateful for that. So when I started picking my own churches in my early 20s, that things started to go awry for me. And it's something I don't talk. I have never really written that publicly about this or spoken that publicly about it. But in my early 20s, and I'm not going to go into the whole story because it's not just my story to tell. But what I experienced at a small church was a pastor who really didn't believe in the legitimacy of a mental health diagnosis. And as somebody who had struggled with anxiety my whole life, and at the time I was doing a job, I was working in social services and kind of this urban ministry where we were working with women struggling with generational poverty, generational trauma. And there were women who struggled with very, very real mental health challenges. And he was basically saying to me, your struggle is really just the sin in your life. Their struggle is just because they believed some wrong. Is this idea that you just need to believe the right things and kind of, you know, be faithful, rigorously faithful to the spiritual disciplines, and these quote unquote mental health challenges will just go away. And that when I pushed, and then when I pushed back on it, that's when kind of the patriarchy aspect of the church really kicked in as well. As a woman, I wasn't really allowed the voice to give that pushback. And we didn't, fortunately, we didn't stay in that church much longer, but it was a deeply wounding experience for us to be kind of confused for a while about, well, maybe he's right. Maybe these challenges I have are the result of just the very sinful, twisted heart that I had. And if I just believe, if I was just a better person, then I'd be okay. And I think a lot of people have had those experiences with pastors in churches, you know, like, is that something you've seen and heard from maybe some of your clients who have been told that by their pastors?
Yeah, I've wanted to believe that that was changing. And I think for a while I saw it changing. Maybe I was a bit naive. I think that there are some who are doubling down with the kind of mentality you experienced, this is a sin problem and you need to repent and believe the gospel more deeply and it'll go away, or practice these practices or whatever, spiritual disciplines, whatever it is, that don't take the reality, the depth, the seriousness of mental health, well, seriously.
Part of the tendency is to kind of approach this from a dualistic perspective. It's like, it's either sin or it's, you know, either you take the sin approach or you take the fully pathologized mental health clinical perspective. And what I've always appreciated are people who have noted the complexity of the human mind, the complexity of the human heart, that yes, there may be false beliefs that are contributing to a mental health struggle. There may be chemical imbalances that are contributing to your behavior that are making you do these things that look an awful lot like sin, but we are holistic beings. Yeah. There is no just spiritual or just physical. Like, we are our bodies, and our bodies include our brains, and our brains include chemicals. And I think that there's still, like, I don't know, what is that? Who do we owe that to? Plato or something? I don't know. I have a degree in philosophy. My undergrad's in philosophy, and it's been a long time. Yeah. But I think we owe that dualism to Plato, right? To kind of think of ourselves as these two separate beings. So you talk about kind of that, these rich spiritual traditions and of, you know, what is the unique role that you think the pastor or the mentor, the shepherd can play that would maybe positively impact our kind of the landscape of our mental health?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, again, there's a sort of a lesson in contrast between the two churches where I've served, where one pathologized mental health and said, go over there and get fixed.
Yeah.
And in the second one, we sort of took this approach of normalizing it. I was in San Francisco. It was cool to have a therapist. So it was helpful in one sense to be in San Francisco during that time. But I think the pastors, the senior pastor and those of us who would preach regularly would normalize it. We would talk about our own work. We'd talk about our own therapy. But even more than that, we wanted to see the church as a safe place for people who were struggling. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, on the one hand, I get the logic that was sort of the prevailing wisdom that's been out there for a while now, where pastors are told, you don't know what the heck you're talking about when it comes to mental health, so you should just refer. Mm-hmm. But I think in a way, there's another larger conversation we could have about how the church has abdicated its role and responsibility to provide care. So if someone is seeing a therapist for an hour each week, where is her support system? Where does she receive care? And do we take seriously the role of the liturgy, how we approach God in worship, prayer, confession, lament, coming to the table, hopefully every week. That would be my preference, and how we experience a kind of depth of care and encouragement at the table. I could go on and on about that, but I think if we could take the role of the church seriously, while at the same time saying, we fully support you going and getting the care you need. In fact, we're going to put our financial backing behind that as well. So that,
that's real. That just got real.
Yeah. Right. So, the reality is in the second church where I served, no one would go without therapy. We would simply, it became such a high value that we would take, at least one offering every year to offset the cost of therapy. So whoever needed it would be able to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So people knew, okay, the church has a counseling center. The church validates this. The pastors talk about it. I can get the care I need. And there are multiple ways in which the church is caring for me and serving me in other ways too.
Yeah. It's funny you should say all that, because like literally the meeting I had just before I hopped onto this podcast interview was my meeting with my therapist. I do it online. She and I used to meet in person and then she moved. Now we meet online and we meet about every 3 weeks. And it's the tools I have learned from her have been incredibly helpful. She is a Christian as well. So we're kind of approaching things from the same worldview, but she's giving me all these kind of, these behavioral tools, these cognitive tools that have really benefited me in life. And also I have over the 8 years I've been meeting with her, I've recognized some of her limitations. And that's just simply that she actually isn't able to observe me in real life. Like that's the kind of imposed boundary of a relationship you would have with a clinical counselor, is that they're not really supposed to be your friends, if that makes sense. You're supposed to kind of have that professional boundary there. But the limitation of that is that she only gets my perspective on what's going on in my marriage, what's going on at work, how I'm behaving in the home. Yeah. She's not really able to observe me. And, you know, kind of the approach she takes is, you know, helping me ask the right questions. And her job really isn't necessarily to admonish at the same level that, say, like a pastor or a mentor would. And so I think that is where I think so many millennials, of which the generation of which I am a part, and Gen X or Gen Z are kind of moving away from the intimacy of pastoral care, and they're all just turning to therapists instead. Yes. And there's a part of me that's like, therapy can be a hard relationship, but it can be pretty safe in many ways. The pastor is able to see what's going on in the nitty gritty of your life, and that can be a real gift. Does that make sense? You know,
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing I kind of want to ask you then is, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the church you went to where it was like kind of cool to be in therapy, like, everybody's in therapy.
Yes.
Do you see, I got to ask this the right way. Do you see that there is potentially maybe this trend in pursuing a clinical mental health diagnosis among people my age and younger? You're very aware of mental health lingo. A lot of words are being diluted, but at the same time, none of us seem to be getting happier or healthier either. Like there's, you know, the stats are pretty dismal in terms of our mental health quality of life. What's going on there, do you think? Do you have any observations on that and what might be happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think years ago, someone wrote a book called The Triumph of the Therapeutic, and maybe it was sort of prophetic, but we're living in that time now. And it's interesting, we're thinking carefully about these things right now at the seminary where I teach, where I'm currently starting a mental health counseling program to train therapists. And one of a couple of our values, I could hit on two things. One is hopeful and humble, and the other is rooted in the Christian soul care tradition. The hopeful and humble piece represents our conviction that therapists have power, a lot of power. And in some ways, they're usurping the power of the pastor in people's lives. And I think that's what you're getting at. And so how do we see ourselves as merely participating rather than playing the central role? How do we understand our power? I think that's one piece. I think the other thing that I get concerned around is when people talk about the triumph of the therapeutic, there's often this, we were talking about dualisms or dichotomies or whatever earlier, you know, this pitting of the psychological against the spiritual. And what I want to say is that the Christian soul care tradition has always deeply valued the psychological, right? And I'm reading a book right now by Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, called The Passions of the Soul. This was an early taxonomy of the the problem of the human heart. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that the passions speak to our deep inclinations and motivations, but you have to get down beneath the surface.
Yeah.
It took a lot of nuancing. And so Evagrius and John Cassian talked about these kinds of things, and it became the subject of St. John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul. And he put words to the deep despair that we experience. And so there are people throughout the history of the church naming the maladies of the soul. St. Augustine wrote 9 chapters of his own story in the Confessions and begins the 10th chapter with Novarum me, novarum te. Let me know myself. Let me know you, O Lord. Mm-hmm. The invitation is self-examination, right? And so when people talk about the therapeutic, they're like, we're getting so narcissistic. We're all about focusing on ourselves. And I want to say, oh no, doing this inner work is a deep part of the Christian soul care tradition. But it's become sort of the only work in the soul focus at times, right? And I think maybe some of what you're seeing and some of what people are naming is we're becoming so inwardly focused. And there is this sense, I think that John O'Donohue, the priest, the poet John O'Donohue, you probably read some of his stuff. He says that we suffer from what he calls a neon consciousness, which is to say, we've learned to shine this bright spotlight of interrogation on our souls, and we think we can figure ourselves out. And the reality is as much as we look, we're still mysteries to ourselves, mysteries to one another. And there's only so much we can know. And I would even argue that psychology is teaching us through the lens of generational trauma, multi-generational trauma, that there's a lot going on inside of you that might not be your mom and dad's fault, you know? Or your coach's fault, or your teacher's fault.
It's easier to blame mom and dad, though.
Yes.
Come on.
Well, we want to find the smoking gun. We believe that psychology will bring us to that thing that happened to us that will explain everything. Mm. And the problem is we can't, there's no neon light that we can shine that will absolutely help us understand everything that's going on with us. I mean, I've been in therapy or in and out of therapy. I was 27, I'm 53 now, you know? And I'm still working stuff out. I feel like I'm more of a mystery to myself in some ways than I. And so, so I think it really, to get back to the hopeful and humble language, it takes a lot of humility to do this work because for those of us who engage as therapists, we sometimes think we have more power than we do. Mm-hmm. And those of us who get therapy, we sometimes think that it will fix us and it doesn't.
Yeah. 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 The realization that therapy and even medication, which has benefited me over the years from time to time, but the realization it wasn't going to fix me fully, that it wasn't going to make life in this world, like it wasn't going to solve the problem of being human, right? Like we're always going to struggle. There's always going to be challenges.
Yes.
Life is never going to be fully comfortable. And I think the work, I guess we're endeavoring to do then is to say, okay, well, how do I live in a way that is as whole as it can possibly be, in a way that honors the Lord and honors the people around me, honors the responsibilities that I have and honors myself, you know? And sometimes that does mean, you know, kind of tackling it at this more psychological clinical level. And to that end, my question for you, I know you could do a whole workshop on this, but if there's a pastor listening, and they want to know, like, okay, how do I know when I'm kind of in over my head as a pastor? Like, I'm trying to shepherd somebody through something, and gosh, I'm feeling like we're not making the progress we need. I know, how do you say this in 5 minutes? But if you could give kind of a short flyover answer to that, what would it be?
Yeah, I always teach my classes. I teach pastoral care classes, and I always tell students, if you're a pastor of a church, have a team on hand, like have a team ready. Have therapists and then local other, you know, other people in other helping professions, have them come in during staff meetings and talk to you about these kinds of things so that you know when you're in over your head. And often it's a gut thing. Often we know as pastors, like, and by the way, as therapists as well, we know sometimes that we're in over our heads because, you know, it's analogous to a general practitioner. If you go to see a general practitioner, she might tell you, listen, this is, I know a little bit about this, but you're going to need to see that specialist, right? And in the same way, a pastor should be able to say, I think I know a little bit about depression, but I'd love for you to see Cynthia. She's down the road. We work closely with her. We'll pay for your first few sessions. Just go and talk to her a little bit about it. And let's you and I meet again in a couple of weeks and tease this out together. And so there is this kind of working relationship that you develop, I think, with local practitioners, where if you have a sense, I think as a pastor, a gut sense that I'm in over my head, okay, that's why you have a good working relationship with that therapist down the road. Let's just have her get in and talk to someone else and just tease it out there for a moment.
Yeah. So it's maybe not the choice between like offloading it entirely or saying, this isn't my realm, I can't handle it. It's partnership, yeah. Maybe.
Partnership. That's exactly it.
I love the practical suggestion of having a fund where you can help, because that's what we get a lot at our church is we're trying to build funds for this and find partners in the community where we can kind of resource people. But I hear that a lot. It's like, well, I can't afford therapy, you know? And if the church was willing to say, we're going to walk with you and also we're going to help you go see a therapist. Like to me, that would be such a gift for the church to provide that, you know?
Yeah. In fact, we just practically, in San Francisco, we reimagined the role and work of the diaconate. We use Tim Keller's book, Ministries of Mercy, among others. And because there was a sense that the deacons, they gave money to people who needed groceries or they met immediate needs like that. And we decided to ask as a diaconate, what if we caught people up? Is it upstream or downstream? I always get that confused. But, you know, what if caught people a little bit earlier in the game, right?
Yeah.
So as to like meet them in places where they're really wrestling with, they're on the verge of marital crisis.
Yeah.
And, we offered some support to them in a way where their marriage wouldn't dissolve and they wouldn't be in need of those groceries or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
And so just to say that we reimagine the work of the diaconate in a way that we could provide that kind of soul care. And again, I was arguing that soul care has always been the vocation of the church, a core vocation of the church, right?
Yeah.
So let's get back to that.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, not to be controversial, but do you think it's oftentimes the pride of a pastor that would maybe prevent them from saying, I need help with this? Like, gosh, the expectations I think pastors have of themselves, the expectations that are placed on them, it's pretty ridiculous. I don't know.
I think that's right. And I think part of it too is I think it could be pride and it could just be a sense of I don't know where the help is. Like one of my assignments in my pastoral care class is for students to develop a portfolio of all the resources. And we're talking about the behavioral health unit at the local hospital. We're talking about the local agency where people can go for counseling at a lower fee. We're talking about the two or three therapists in the area that we trust to work with people from a Christian point of view. We're talking about developing a whole portfolio of these resources. And what they'll tell me often is, I would not have known. I wouldn't have thought to ask even, right? And so I think it could be some pride. It could be some fear too.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't trained in seminary to ask those kinds of questions. So when someone comes to me and says, my spouse is suffering from hallucinations. They get fearful. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. Where do I go? Yeah. Who do I talk to? And so I want to set them up for confidence in those situations to be able to say, I think that's probably something where you're going to need to go to your local hospital, to the behavioral care unit, and talk to someone there, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I've been having conversations with a friend that's just about to graduate from seminary and, you know, it took him like 5 years. It's, you know, 120 hours, all this. And he was like, all the class, he's being trained to be a pastor, all the classes he had in Greek, all Old Testament, New Testament, Hebrew. He's like, I had one pastoral care class and no mercy ministries class. This idea that we're training pastors to be orators and teachers, and that's a huge component of church leadership.
Yeah.
But I think until we shift our mindset to say it's what is the role of a shepherd? If we're teaching them that it's just to teach and just to get on a stage and deliver, you know, like a 20-minute Bible TED talk every Sunday, then we're missing so much opportunity to for the real inner work to happen alongside mm-hmm. people. And what would happen if seminary shifted to 50% of their curriculum was this soul care piece that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it requires a whole reimagination around this that I don't know that we're, you know, as I spent a good amount of time, I've taught at a few different seminaries, either part-time or now full-time, and there's not an imagination for these things in many places. So it's kind of sad.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe enough pastors will say this isn't sustainable, that there will be a shift. Well, the last question I want to ask you is, you know, that we hear the term you've heard the term spiritual bypassing a lot.
Yes.
It often goes along with the term toxic positivity and things like that. And
yeah.
I wrestle with these terms because I want to know the difference between spiritual bypassing, but also lovingly reminding people of the hope we have in Christ.
Yeah.
How do you do that well as a pastor?
I often contrast hope with optimism. But I think toxic positivity is a good way of talking about. When I think of spiritual bypassing, though, I think of the Exodus journey. The first book I ever wrote was called Leaving Egypt, Finding God in the Wilderness Places. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I used to say when I taught on that was, God didn't provide a helicopter to go over the wilderness. You have to go through a wilderness. And what should have been an 11-day journey took 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to go through the suffering, and that often feels just really hard for people. Like, really, I've got to go through it. There's not some way around it. But I think it's really interesting. When I read Paul, the Apostle Paul, I always see hope in the context of suffering,
mm-hmm.
And understanding that because Christ has gone through it first, mm-hmm. we can go through it with a sense that not that it's going to be easy, not that it's going to be pain-free, but that we will emerge in some way, sometimes in ways that are unexpected and mysterious to us on the other side. And so I do think there is some sense in which when I'm inviting people into the deepest places of their pain as a pastor, as a therapist, as a mentor, as a friend, I know it's probably going to get darker for them. But I also know, if I believe Paul, I also know that that's where they're going to meet Jesus,
mm-hmm.
in that darkest night, right? Mm-hmm. In that Holy Saturday. We're recording this on Easter Monday, right?
Yeah.
Two days ago, Holy Saturday. I've watched people go through those dark nights, and there are times when, I mean, frankly, I'm like, oh my goodness, I've invited them into this. And I'm not entirely sure they're ever going to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then mysteriously, because it's not me,
mm-hmm.
It's not me sort of pulling the strings as a therapist or a pastor, it's the Spirit. Mysteriously, they find their way to what St. John of the Cross calls the dawn on the horizon, you know, the mm-hmm. dawn after the dark night. And there's that sense of, oh, there's hope. I can see it. I don't quite know how I'll get there. I don't quite know how long it'll take, but I see it emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that because I've seen it over the years. But I don't think there's any way to bypass the real pain mm-hmm. unless you want to, for the rest of your life, play a game of like psychological whack-a-mole. You know, just knocking it down. And that's not hope to me. That's control.
Yeah. It reminds me of one of my 3-year-old's favorite books. Actually, just before we hit record, for my listeners, my 3-year-old walked in and wanted to be part of this podcast interview with Chuck DeGroat. One of her favorite books is that bear hunt book, you know, where it's like, we're going on a bear hunt, we're going to catch a big one. And they run into, you know, a forest and a lake, and it's like, you can't go over it, can't go around it, can't go under mm-hmm. it. You got to go through it. And so, you know, they go through the forest, they go through the storm. And I think that's a really important truth. Like most things in life, you can't go around it, can't go over it, can't go under it. You got to go through it. And it's a long journey, you know?
That's right.
Well, Chuck, tell people first tell us a little bit about your new book that's coming out. And by the time this podcast releases, it might be available for pre-order, but if not, it will be soon. So just tell us what you're working on.
I think it's even out there available for pre-order already. It's called Healing What's Within, Coming Home to Yourself and to God When You're Wounded, Weary, and Wandering. And talking a lot about abuse within the context of the church these days. And in fact, I've done a little writing on that myself. But for me, it's sort of a way of turning the page to say, we can talk about the things that happened to us, but to heal, we have to address the imprint of the pain that we've experienced within us. And we call that trauma. And a lot of people are talking about trauma nowadays. So I really wanted to approach it more biblically. I used three questions that God asked in Genesis 3. Where are you? Who told you? And where have you taken your hunger and thirst? And that becomes sort of a biblical frame for God showing up as a compassionate witness to us in the midst of our wounds. And so I'm hoping that we wanted to write it to sort of frame this conversation for pastors and leaders in the church who are like, why is everyone talking about trauma right now? And to say, hey, there's a reason for us to engage this conversation as Christians with a kind of biblical frame.
So, oh gosh, that's going to be so helpful. And where can people find you online if they want to look at more of your work?
ChuckDeGroat.net is my website, but I teach at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, if they want to check out the work we're doing here. And then on the socials, you know, we're all kind of like most of the time doing this.
Speaking of trauma, those are going to be dangerous places, but. Well, you're one of the nice people on the internet, Chuck, truly. And I've appreciated your encouragement and really appreciate your work. I think you're just such a critical voice in the church right now. So keep doing what you're doing. And thank you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Grateful to get some time with you.
Finally. Let's do it again.